You're listening to Radio Influence.
Why, Crusher, it's good to see you.
You're listening to Crush Performance with the Crusher, Jeff Crushell. Get in on the talent grid and text Crush at 101260 with your questions, comments, or smart-ass remarks.
And welcome to the show, everybody. Jeff Crushell here, the con man behind the glass, keeping us on track. And we're your weekly source for performance information. Again, crushperformance.com is our website. On Twitter, at Jeff Crush, and on Facebook, go to Crush Performance. I first off want to thank everybody who put their name into our annual Crush Stuff Your Stocking gift giveaway. We practically did your shopping for you, and we gave it all away. Those winners were announced last week, and we're overwhelmed by the response. I want to thank everybody for getting in on the action and following us this last year on Crush Performance. It was a big year. As I mentioned, in 2017, we had a lot of outstanding guests, some great conversations, unbelievable feedback from our listenership. Our blog really took off on our website, and I also want to thank everybody who works on our podcast as well, as we just try to spread the good word. Helping people tap into their potential. That's our goal and objective. And I think people are actually surprised once they get into a system, once they get into the right mindset, and once they get the right people around them, how easy it is to actually get good at something. We always say in our world of Crush Performance, greatness is up for grabs if you just know what to do. The show, of course, is for parents, athletes, coaches, managers, business owners, and anybody else who's just trying to get good at something they love to do. And our 2017 campaign was a powerful one. Today, we're going to go back and look at some of the great interviews and discussions we had over this last year. We will be going back to a conversation we had last February with one of the famed Polgar sisters. We were joined by Judith Polgar to talk about her upbringing and how the environment really steered her and her sisters to stardom in the world of chess. It is a conversation about environment and the power of environment on development. I also today want to go back to a great conversation we had with our good friend David Howman, former Director General of the World Anti-Doping Agency and now the chair of the Athletics Integrity Unit. A move by the IAAF after the scathing Russian doping probe that really opened our eyes to what's going on behind the scenes in certain parts of the world when it comes to high-performance sport. And the IAAF stepped outside the box to initiate the Athletics Integrity Unit in a step to fight corruption in sport and doping, of course, to really, I guess, maybe help boost the movement and the power of WADA and the anti-doping movement. We spoke with David Howman about the issues in sport right now and what he feels the Athletics Integrity Unit means, not just for the sport of athletics, but sport in general. A powerful conversation. And then in March, we had a very powerful conversation. And this is a podcast I think everybody should maybe go back and revisit. I wanted to play part of this conversation we had with the president of the Taylor Hooton Foundation, Donald Hooton Jr., where we spoke about the issues of drug use, doping in kids and sport, and the impact of doping on the mindset, the health, the mental well-being of young athletes. A really, really important conversation that I want to replay today as we recap some of our top conversations for 2017. So let's start here. Let's go back to the conversation of nature versus nurture with one of the most powerful real life experiments as we spoke with Judith Polgar. We're talking with Judith Polgar, one of the famed Polgar sisters. Judith was, when she became a grandmaster at 15 years and 4 months, the youngest grandmaster ever, and she's the winningest and highest ranked female player of all time. Judith, you know, it's interesting what you mentioned, that you remember the games and you remember the plays and you remember the sequences. We do a lot of work with professional athletes in baseball, in soccer, in football, and hockey. And it's interesting because those top performers remember virtually every game, every goal, and they recall their games as well. I wonder if this has something to do with the way the mind gets programmed when you're so entrenched at a high performance level in an endeavor, whether it's chess, music, or sports. A very interesting perspective or concept.
I also believe that it is very interesting that practically when you know something really well, you're really an expert in that, you don't actually do the things what you see, what the average people see. Actually, we have it in our blood, in our heart, in our movement. And visually, we can replay it. It's no matter whether it's chess or in other sport, or even if you love movies, of course you can talk about movies, right? That, wow, in this situation, what happened? What did he say? And you recall it, right?
Right.
It's the same thing on a high level in any, and it's not only a sport. I think it's every profession you're in. You have to have this special vision that you simply have it as a picture visually. You see things front of you, or no matter whether you're watching out to the sky or a building, you have it somehow when you talk about it. You really visualize the situation. And once I had a festival in Hungary, the Global Chess Festival, and once I wanted to show this also, that it, whether it's music or chess, or even a Rubik's Cube, you can do all these things blindfolded without seeing any of the three, because simply you do it so much and you're so intensely involved that you know what move comes after which move, or what hit comes after. So this is something really special when you're deeply involved in something that. It's not only in chess. In chess, of course, with chess grandmasters, it's very typical that after a game or before a game, we are taking a walk and then we are discussing a chess line, chess position. It is something very common.
Judith, that's very interesting. I think that maybe your father had an idea that this was the case long before the sisters were born, and this is something he was thinking about. Hey, Judith, can you remember back when you were a young girl playing at the highest level? And how your approach to the game changed as you got older and matured and played some of the top players in the world. Can you remember a change in perspective, or do you recall the way your thought process changed as you matured as an expert chess player?
Absolutely. In the beginning, when I was very little, a child, when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, for quite a few years, up to age 12 or 13, it was practically a game. Everything worked out the way I wanted. I was beating up adults, grown-up men. I won many tournaments. I was part of the Olympic gold medalist team. So somehow everything was turning into gold where I was playing. And this gave me a lot of self-confidence, and everything seemed to be so easy for me. And then when I entered into the top competitions, when I was 13, I became in the top 30 in the world in absolute between men and women, and became number one between the female ranking. After that, something changed. Of course, all these gambits and very spectacular play did not work exactly all the time when I was playing against stronger opposition. And then I had to learn to pull myself back, to control myself more, to spend more time on preparation, also to spend more time during the game, to be more careful, think twice with my decisions. And so this also formed my play. Like I started to play different openings, different systems, different structure, different strategies against different people. And of course, experience gives also a lot of extra to my my knowledge, my play. But it also sometimes makes you lazy, that you want to rely on your experience. So it is something that is changing time to time. But also, I had some difficult times when you work a lot, but still things somehow don't work on your way. And it happened that it was about around 2000 when I had some crisis, that no matter where I was playing, somehow things did not work the way I wanted. And then the most important thing is to not to be distracted and not to be disappointed as much that you want to throw away the game, but to stay calm and go back after a bad tournament and analyze with critical thinking what things you did and why did it go wrong. And of course, these things always change you. The most important thing is to be able to fight and be competitive for being there for many decades. is somehow to find for yourself new challenges and create motivation.
Judith, in the developmental model, there comes a time when the skill set is established, the technical side is established, and even the experience level gets to a point where there's something else that needs to be added in order for the performer to go to the next level. And usually that's the point where competition becomes so, so important. Good competition at the right time can really push the development of a young performer forward. Was there a time when competition really helped you develop? And what were some of the toughest competitions that you ever had? And what did you learn from them?
I had a few difficult matches, but I would say that, for example, to play against Kasparov when I was playing first time, I was 17, but later on I played with him many times. For example, against him, it was extremely difficult to play for me in the beginning, as he had such a charisma that when I sat down to the board, practically I've lost the game without making a single move. And why is that possible? It's because psychology is a big part of chess. And he had such an image of great preparation. And of course, he was the world champion already by that time. And he has such an aura and charisma sitting there that he was like, I had the feeling he wants to eat me up alive there. So, but actually he's kind of an exception that he has such a strong personality and presence at the board. And of course, against him, it took me a lot of time to discover how can I use a good strategy, it can work, that actually at all I'm playing a balanced game against him, a normal fight, even though he was better, at least I'm not afraid so much that I'm going to lose the game for sure. And it's only technicality that we make some moves. And it took me years. And eventually I found a strategy which where I used his own weapon against him in the same system what he's usually playing. I was using it against him. And somehow it worked. So that was maybe one of the biggest turnover for me. From this point of view, that I had a very bad score against him, and finally I made a few very important draws first, and then finally I beat him. I had also, against some other players, also I had the different difficulties.
Interesting. Well, competition is important, and I have to ask you, Judith, growing up, you must have had some great matches against your sisters. How heated was that, playing your siblings, and was that a different approach? Was it more cutthroat, you know? Were you guys pretty competitive as young players, or how did it go when you played your sisters?
Well, it was interesting because Susan was much many years ahead of me, and then when I was about 9, 10, I was in the living room. She had already serious training, and I wanted to sneak in to learn more from her and her trainer. But of course, I was not allowed. But sometimes, even though when they had a break, I sneaked in and I was trying to show how clever I am. And, and sometimes I had already some good ideas, and they couldn't prove that they are right all the time. And then more and more occasions it became that I said some interesting ideas. And I also played with my sisters, which was a lot of fun. We almost played daily basis, a lot of blitz games, which means for each game we had each of us 5 minutes for the whole game. We played many of those. And of course, we had a healthy competitive attitude towards, and we wanted to beat one another. And there were some period of time where we were, the games were quite balanced, because in strength we were pretty near to each other. So it was a very healthy competition. And of course, when you're a sport person, you're competing, you want to win. That's very clear.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have two brothers and a sister, and I tell you, when we either played checkers or chess or Monopoly, I hated to lose. If there was one group of people that I wanted to kick butt, it was my brothers and sisters. So I can imagine when the Polgar sisters get together and sit down to a game of chess, it's fairly heated, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we wanted to win. And then if one wins, then we are talking about it for days that I beat you. And then she wanted to take your revenge.
Yeah.
So it was always going on back and forth.
I love it. And that's sisterly love there. Nothing greater than sibling rivalries. We're joined by Judith Polgar, Grandmaster chess player and the most successful female player of all time. Judith, thank you so much for your time today. Listen, before we go, your life has taken a big change. You retired in 2014, and you moved on to pursue some other great interests. The Judith Polgar Chess Foundation is an incredible organization that does a lot of things for young people and also for the game of chess. And you've also authored a good number of books. How has your life changed since chess has sort of taken the back seat now?
Well, my life didn't come too much calmer than before, but it transformed quite a bit. Well, first of all, I spend more time with my kids, which they need a lot because they are getting starting to be early teenage years. They are 10 and 12. But from chess point of view, I was the captain for the Hungarian men's national team for nearly 2 years. I'm doing a chess festival in Hungary. I'm building a community with Chess Connect Us. I hope that each year, October 2nd, Saturday, will be a chess celebration day all over the world. And we have a website for this where I want to upload all the possible events on that day. This year is going to be 14th of October, that I want to show to the world that chess is not by chance a 1,500 years old ancient game. It has such a resources from many aspects. Also, not only from sport, but also cultural, social, educational point of view. We have a festival there, which we are organizing every year. And this year, we are also going to have a big chess event and all kind of side events. Also, we have an educational program, which is implemented in Hungary in the educational system. It's an optional subject starting from 2013. Already many hundreds of schools are using it, the Chess Palace program. We are working now on the kindergarten part, which is the chess playground program. It's going to be for kindergarten age, preschool. Now I'm working with the UN Women as a Planet 50-50 champion. So I have many, many things I'm working on, and also I'd like to do more for promoting chess. I was the commentator last November in New York at the World Championship match between Carlsen and Karjakin. So there are a lot of interesting things and journeys I'm doing at the moment and looking forward to do more.
Well, Judith, thank you so much for your time today. Listen, you lived through what might be one of the greatest talent and learning experiments of all time. For all the parents, coaches, athletes, competitors, and experts out there, what would be the takeaway from your lifelong experience growing up in that environment, coming through, now having kids of your own, and then participating in the game that you love, chess? What would be a big takeaway for people to think about when we're looking at developing young talent and pursuing our dreams?
Generally, for example, for my success, I usually say there are the three P's, which is necessary, and it was obliged in my career. It's practice, perseverance, and passion, what you're doing. I mean, without these three, you're not going to reach the highest level for sure, I think. But generally, I think it's the most important thing, the journey, not the destination. But still, you have to put your goals to the highest, so at least you know the direction where you're heading to. And also, it's a lifelong learning journey.
We never stop learning. That is the absolute truth. Judith, so much. Thank you so much for your time today. Listen, we'll look forward to following you. The website is judithpolgar.com, and we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
There you go. Just a fantastic conversation. It's the age-old discussion, nature versus nurture. Well, I think from this discussion, we can see the power of environment on skill acquisition and talent development. No doubt about it. What a fantastic conversation that was. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and we're going to look at the dark side of sport. What is going on? Well, we spoke earlier this year with David Howman, the newly appointed chair of the Athletics Integrity Unit about where we're at when it comes to doping in sport. Can we get ahead of the dark side? And what exactly will the Athletics Integrity Unit mean to sport? Just a fantastic conversation with David Hellman coming up on a Crush Year in Review right after this. Stick around, everyone.
Radio Influence brings you the absolute best in digital audio broadcasting. We've got something for everyone. Sports personalities like the fabulous Sports Babe, Rich Herrera, and former Major League Baseball manager Kevin Kennedy as they take you inside the dugout. We'll take you inside the world of MMA with the MMA Report with Jason Floyd, the MMA Insiders, and the Valor Hour with Tim Loy and Casey Oxendine. Or you could find yourself sitting ringside with wrestling ring announcer David Penzer. TV law enforcement analyst and former police officer Vincent Hill breaks down this week's biggest crime stories and takes you beyond the badge. Chef Brian Duffy from TV's Bar Rescue shares his crazy life on the road with Duffified Live. And Scott Ledger will always make you think with some dangerous conversation. All of Radio Influence's shows can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.
You're listening to Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. Get the Crush blogs, podcasts, and performance links at CrushPerformance.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to a Crush Performance Year in Review. I am Jeff Crochelle. The con man is right here. And we're your weekly source for performance information. The website, CrushPerformance.com. If you're on Twitter, at Jeff Crush. And if you're on the Facebook, go to our page. It's called Crush Performance. We're just hooking you up with the world of talent development and skill acquisition, all in hopes of helping you reach your potential. So late 2016, early 2017, the sporting world was rocked with news of a state-run doping program in Russia. The Russian athletes and the Athletics Federation paid the price in the Olympics in Rio, of course. We all know that. And that has moved forward. And in response, the IAAF went outside the box and started something called the Athletics Integrity Unit. We spoke with our good friend David Hellman, the newly appointed chair of the AIU, about the task force, what it's all about, and can we actually get ahead of doping in sport? Here's that great conversation. David, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Jeff.
Well, I've been really excited to talk to you, and I'm not going to lie, I was really excited when I heard that you were the chair of this new venture, this new program called the Athletics Integrity Unit. And I'll tell you, I really hadn't heard a lot about it until the media release came out, but this is a very bold and interesting move by the IAAF, David.
It's a move that indicates that sport really wants to make sure that it looks after its own values and its integrity by independent ways, rather than being dogged with a criticism that you can't be, the guard of the good, and then on the other hand have to sort of stand up and look after other issues in sport like corruption. So Seb Coe, when he became the president of the IAAF, decided that he would look at a new way of addressing issues of integrity, and this covers not only doping, but also matters of bribery and match fixing and corruption and so on. He wanted to address it in a way which was distant from his board, his Congress, so that he could say when matters arose that these were issues that were not under his purview but under the mandate of this new unit. And it took about 12 months, I think, for athletics to go through a governance process to establish what we now have in place.
Well, the Athletics Integrity Unit, it's the first internationally delegation that has complete autonomy in sort of managing the integrity of the sport of athletics. This is an interesting move, and it's the first time it's happened in sport. David, you have a very, very interesting perspective on this, you know, being the former director general of WADA. When this was coming together, what was sort of your take on it and your vision in the big picture?
Well, over the last 5 or 6 years, I have been advocating internationally that not only do we need WADA as the independent body relating to the doping issues that are being confronted by sport, but also another body which might look at the matters that now falls under the mandate of this new unit, like bribery and corruption and match fixing, because those were issues that we were seeing at WADA by our relationship with police, Interpol, and so on, as being matters that had to be dealt with in a strong fashion. And you couldn't just deal with doping. You had to deal with these other matters as well. So for a long time, I've been saying that instead of just having a world anti-doping agency, we might be looking more fruitfully at a world integrity body which does oversee and monitor all those aspects. And so when this athletics matter came along and I was approached to consider putting my name forward to chair the board, I was pretty excited, Jeff. I just saw this as a way that led on from what I had been doing for the last 13 or 14 years and provided an advance in the way that sport can stand up for its values. And so I've maintained that excitement as we've continued the path in establishing the unit.
I really like it. We're talking with David Howman, the newly appointed chair for the Athletics Integrity Unit for the IAAF. Well, you know, I really like what you say here. You have been to the war. You've been to the battlefield, to the front line with WADA. This goes beyond WADA. So, David, my question is, will the AIU act as an arm of WADA in terms of the doping and the testing for the IAAF?
Yes, it will. It looks at all matters relating to doping. And so the unit will be essentially the athletic response to matters relating to the World Anti-Doping Code. So that's part of our mandate. And that they in the unit will continue to run the anti-doping program, but they will add to that the matters that fall more generally under issues of integrity and look at complaints that will be received in relation to corruption. We have a mandate to look at matters in respect of age manipulation, because there are some concerns that some athletes that perform at World Junior events may not be the age that they say they are.
Hmm.
We will be looking at all issues which affect athletics off the field of play. In other words, the matters that do happen on the field of play will remain the domain of the International Athletics Federation. And that's the way it should be. And so the division that we've got allows us the autonomy you mentioned and gives us a budget that we are able to spend. We have to account for it, obviously, but we have no restrictions or constraints in the way that we conduct the program. And I think that's a considerable vote of confidence in a new body, and I hope we live up to the responsibility that we've been given.
Well, I think this is a very exciting time for sport in general. We're talking with David Howman, the former Director General of the World Anti-Doping Agency and the newly appointed chair to the Athletics Integrity Unit for the IAAF. So if I were to say, in terms of the doping responsibilities for the AIU, would it be sort of in parallel to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency or the Canadian Center Ethics in Sports? You'll oversee that now, not so much for a country, but for a sporting organization, which is the IAAF. I really like this approach.
Yes, that's correct. And we will have relationships with USADA and the other national anti-doping agencies to help ensure that the tests that are conducted are ones that are not random. They're done on a basis of intelligence, and they're not duplicated by national anti-doping agencies testing the same athlete at the same time. That just doesn't make any sense. And so we will have good relationships, I think, with the bodies you mentioned and many others to make sure that we work together and not against each other. This is the international sport responsibility. There are responsibilities that have to be carried out at a national level, which USADA, of course, does in the United States. And we will work with them in the way I've just outlined.
I really like this. And it goes well beyond the doping, as you mentioned. Bribery and corruption, match fixing, which is a serious problem. We have the age manipulation, as you mentioned, the betting and gambling, the manipulation of competitive results, which, you know, we've all seen at one time or another in international sports. And, of course, the transfer of allegiance. So there's a lot of different things that you guys will be covering. I really like this, David, and I think this is something and I'm sure you agree with this, that other sporting organizations will look seriously at to see how this goes for the IAAF.
I think we will be under scrutiny, Jeff, and I think that's a fair scrutiny to provide, because nobody has had the gumption yet to have this sort of model, which does have with it a bit of pressure and stress on us. We've got to deliver it properly. But I think it does give the opportunity of showing that these things can be done in a fair, independent fashion, and not be overcome by people saying, well, you're doing this because you're trying to protect your sport. This gives sport an opportunity to say, no, we're not doing it. We've given it to independent people who we trust to deliver properly. And that's as I say, a bit of a responsibility on our shoulders, but I'm sure we can deliver.
It's a real brilliant move by the IAAF and CIDCO because of what we've seen in athletics here over the last, 3 to 4 years, especially in the lead up to Rio with the Russian fiasco. So I really like this bold move by the IAAF, David.
I think CIDCO has shown a lot of guts in doing this because there are many people running world sport who don't like to get rid of any control over any aspect of their sport. And this essentially is relinquishing control over the areas that we've talked about today without any fear. And I think that's a very strong attribute that he shoulders and a very strong leadership ability that he will take athletics into the next decade.
We're talking with David Hellman, the chair of the Athletes Integrity Unit for the IAAF. One other aspect of this new body that's really interesting to me is the education aspect for the athletes and coaches and performance teams. I think this is a real valuable part of this organization as well.
Well, I think it's mandatory to have a really, really good education process so that everybody is understanding of the rules that they're operating under, but more particularly the values in which they look at their sport. And so we divide education, I think, Jeff, into sort of two aspects. One is giving information about processes and rules and so on, but the other is more teaching and teaching values and explaining to not only the athletes but also their advisors and coaches and trainers and so on what the values of sport really are and to uphold them. You know, we're talking about respect for your opposition, respect for the officials, honesty and fair play, all those sorts of really strong values that we believe in sport, so that we have fair competition, strong competition, but fair competition. And I think going forward, those messages will be delivered in very good ways by the education programs that will be established.
Yeah, David, I think the sporting world was rocked by what was discovered in Russia, last year and leading up to Rio. And I like these initiatives that are now coming forward because of, things that are taking us by surprise. We know for the most part there are great characters, great ethics, and some great athletes in sport that want to see it perfectly clean. If I were to ask you, David, in all your experiences at WADA and now this new adventure with the IAAF and the Athletics Integrity Unit, one of the things we talk about on our show all the time when it comes to solving problems is clearly identifying the problems. And you and I have talked about this before, but I'd just like to get maybe your view on this or just your thoughts on this, about why athletes go to the dark side. Now, we know the fame and the fortune is certainly one thing, but do you think that athletes sometimes get caught not knowing what to do to maintain their athletic prowess or to improve their athletic prowess, or maybe they surround themselves with the wrong people? There's a lot of factors involved here.
Yes, look, I've in a former life, I represented a lot of athletes. So before I went to WADA, I was an advocate or a lawyer or a sort of agent for athletes, and I understood a lot more about the issues that they go through during that period of my life. And when you're an athlete and you're a young person, I would say naive and innocent in many ways in the ways of the world, you are listening to people who are advising you and trusting their advice. And regrettably, there are many around who are not working with the same values as you might as an athlete hold. And you get persuaded to do things that you mightn't otherwise have been going to do because you think these people are right. And those are the ones that we really need to address, the rogue coaches or the rogue doctors or the rogue lawyers who are really in it for the dollars and not for the right reasons. And they're the ones that I fear the most, the ones that really do upset young people. I've got a lot of time for young athletes, and I think we have to respect their abilities and the way we can forward their talent in a fair and honest fashion, not one where they're taught to go over to the dark side because that's the way they're going to make money. And that's the temptation, Jeff, that's out there, and we've got to aggressively deal with it.
I think, David, sometimes the transparency and the public eye is a powerful tool. We saw that with the International Cycling Union. They're not afraid when they get even one of their top athletes caught with their hand in the cookie jar or going to the dark side. They don't hesitate to throw that in the front page of the news. We're seeing it now in Major League Baseball, who has really taken a shift and now have one of the strongest, you know, testing protocols in professional sport. So I think that's also a deterrent. But this education side is going to be the real rub in this whole movement forward. Don't you agree?
I do agree. And I think I agree also with you about public scrutiny. And we owe a lot in sport to journalism, because I think some of these issues would have remained undercover, if you like, if it weren't for good investigative journalism and people who are prepared to talk the talk. Baseball is a very good example. And I think Rob Manfred, the current commissioner, has to be congratulated on the stance that he took when he was general counsel in ensuring that baseball cleaned its act up. And it has. And I think is all the better for it, because people knew that there was something rotten going on and couldn't put their finger quite on it, but knew it wasn't good. And now that has changed. So you can do it by having champions. You can do it by having scrutiny. And certainly you want public understanding and public support as you go forward in these new ventures.
David, listen, thank you so much for your time today. I know it's a very busy time for you as the Athletics Integrity Unit gets underway. Just in terms of timeline, though, where are we at with the IAAF Athletics Integrity Unit, and what can we look for in the coming months in terms of rollout?
Well, the board was established in April. We've had several meetings of the board, so the governance side of things is underway. The first task was to appoint a CEO, and we've just completed that. And the new CEO of the unit is Brett Clothier, who at the present has that role with the Australian Football League, which is the equivalent in Australia of the NFL, and has done a lot of work in integrity in that sport. That probably has the best approach that I've seen in my life of a sport towards these issues. So he's going to be joining the unit in the next few weeks. We have a big event coming up in London, the World Athletic Championships, in early August.
Yes.
So there'll be a lot of meetings and opportunities to talk with the athletes, to open up our education program during the week prior to that event and obviously during it. That's really the lead out that we've got in mind. There'll be a lot of athletes who are part of the anti-doping program in the lead-up, to ensure that we have clean athletes at the event in the normal sort of doping program approach. And then it will be business as usual. We've got a lot on the plate. There's a lot of cases that we're scrutinizing at the present. We've just got to get on with it, Jeff.
I like it, David Howman, and I'm glad you're involved there. I was really happy to hear about it, and I will be... And we'll be following the Athletics Integrity Unit with great, great interest. Congratulations on this new movement. And I think, you know, in the big picture, this is a really, really important time in sport.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I'm looking forward to carrying out my responsibility. It's a big part, really, when you look at it. But the overseeing of everything that we do has its responsibility, and I certainly will do my part. And I'm very happy to keep in touch with you as we go on.
Great. Thank you, David, so much, and I appreciate your time today.
Pleasure, Jeff.
And there you have it, a great conversation with our good friend David Howman as he continues to fight the good fight, upholding the integrity of sport. When we come back on A Crush Year in Review, staying on the theme of doping in sport, earlier in the year we asked the question on steroids, are your kids using? Alarming numbers right after this. Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sports scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Kershaw, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.
Find out what it takes to be a top performer. Get the Crush blog, podcast, and newsletter at crushperformance.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to a Crush Performance Year in Review, everyone. Jeff Kershaw here, the con man's behind the glass. If you want to get in touch with us with any questions, comments, or smart remarks, do so. We love them all. CrushPerformance.com. Go to the contact page and reach out to us there on Twitter, at Jeff Crush. And on the Facebook, go to our page, Crush Performance. Before we part ways today, I wanted to get in a portion of a very important conversation we had back in March with Donald Hooton Jr., the president of the Taylor Hooton Foundation. We asked the question, are your kids using steroids? Well, the numbers are alarming. About 1.5 million teens admit to using. 62.5% of steroid users do it to improve their looks. They're not even athletes. 85% of high school students have never had a parent, teacher, or coach talk to them about the dangers of using performance-enhancing drugs. And this stuff is really, really easy to get. Here's Donald Hooton Jr. of the Taylor Hooton Foundation.
It is. And, you know, this stuff is going on. A lot of parents say, well, how, you know, how do people get a hold of this? Well, this stuff is going on in our local gyms. It's very, very easy to get a hold of. And in Taylor's case, Taylor was purchasing his from a young man at the YMCA, which for most parents would think that's the safest place I can send my child to work out or do after school activities. But, you know, let's not be lulled to sleep here. These drugs are very easy to obtain. You can purchase them over the internet. They are being sold in our gyms and in our schools.
Yeah, and that's where awareness comes in. And Don, the conversations are now so important. Let's talk about the foundation, some of the great events you plan, and some of the resources that you're providing to the communities out there. Again, the website is taylorhooton.org. It's the Taylor Hooton Foundation, and you guys have set up a real important base where athletes, parents, and coaches can go to get more information and get educated on the dangers of the use of steroids and appearance-altering drugs.
Yeah, so, you know, our website is a tremendous resource for people to come to and get more information. But because of the help of Major League Baseball that we've received over the 10-plus years we've been working with them, it's allowed us to develop an incredible in-school program. We call that our Hooch Chalk Talk program. One of the sessions that we provide talks about the dangers of appearance and performance-enhancing drugs. Everything from the dietary supplement industry to how body image and current day advertising targets these kids to have this body image. And then also the side effects of anabolic steroids, where they're coming from, as well as human growth hormone, which is on the rise as well. So outside of that program, we've developed a brand new program called Dietary Supplement Safety and Nutrition, which where we come into a school and we talk about, you know, how to eat and, you know, what you can do through foods, you know, to help achieve your goals, whether that's losing weight, whether that's putting on muscle. And then we talk about, you know, where to find supplements or how do they work in our diet and how to make sure that what you're taking is free of banned substances.
Well, and there's a tall order right there, because let's face it, the supplement world itself is just another scary part of this conversation. It might be one of the most unregulated and dangerous places in our food industry right now. Let's talk about this just to raise a little awareness. Yeah. Look, we know that the supplements are uncontrolled. There are programs out there that are helping, but boy, proceed with caution if you're using supplements at any level of sport.
So what we have found, Jeff, I'm glad you want to talk about this because it's so important, and you see so many of our people taking this or parents buying it for them or parents taking it themselves. If it's labeled a dietary supplement, it is not considered a food. Therefore, there is no regulation or very little regulation on these products. Because so, what we found out working in this industry is one in every four or 25% of over-the-counter dietary supplements, you know, have tested positive for a banned substance. That could be anabolic steroids. We've heard of these things being laced with Viagra. And one of the stories I like to share with anybody that I talk to is about a year and a half ago, I was doing some programs and had the opportunity to talk to middle school students, high school students, and college students that would continue to bring me the same product over and over. So I said, all right. So we called one of the partners we work with, NSF Certified for Sport.
Yep.
And they began testing this product. And what they found out was that this product tested positive for meth-like compounds. So you had young people buying this stuff over the counter, and it had meth in it.
So stimulants. So we're talking about stimulants. We're talking about diuretics. We're talking about, you know, the anabolic substances, which we've seen through the 2001 IOC study. Listen, Don, this is a scary, scary place to be. We have athletes bringing protein powders and nitric oxide boosters and creatine powders to us all the time. And I'm just telling you what, I throw my hands up in the air, and it's just too dangerous for me to even recommend supplements nowadays. So you're so right. Proceed with caution here, because boy, oh boy, this is out of control. And not just that, we know the stories about cross-contamination, but some of these companies are intentionally putting in substances to get a benefit or getting a result for the consumer.
Absolutely. And when people ask us, because we don't recommend any products, but when people ask us, hey, well, what products are good? What we do is we refer them to NSFSport.com. NSF Certified for Sport Batch Test Dietary Supplements. So if you were a product manufacturer, you were making a protein powder or creatine or a multivitamin, you could send your products to NSF voluntarily. And what they do is they test the products to ensure that everything that's on that label is actually what's in that product and that they are free of banned substances. And they work with all the various sports organizations. So it's a tremendous resource because they have an app that you can download, or you could also visit their website to read more about the products they're testing, the type of products. And that is what we recommend people to do if they're going to decide they're going to use any of these dietary supplement products.
Yeah, and that's not to be taken lightly either, because we know that there are, you know, parents, again, providing supplements for their kids at very, very young ages. Look, it's a supplement. It's not a substitute for good nutrition. It's something we may use to supplement a good dietary plan. And even then, if you're really eating properly, the question then becomes, do you even need a supplement? So what a great conversation this is.
Yeah. And for most of our young people that are eating a full balanced diet, you know, there's really no need for dietary supplements. And before we were, you know, any young person should take any of these products, we always recommend, number one, to see your family physician, but two, to hire a registered dietitian, a sports dietitian, somebody that can evaluate what you're currently putting in your body to see if you can achieve the goals through food versus taking some of these products, and what products, if you are taking these, should you be taking.
Oh, Don, listen, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a great, great conversation. It's Donald Hooton, the president of the Taylor Hooton Foundation. The website, again, taylorhooton.org. Hey, listen, Don, thanks for everything you guys have done in Taylor's name. I can't imagine the number of lives and careers and even just the impact you guys have had. So thanks for everything you guys do.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate you giving me the time today.
And there you go, one of the more powerful conversations we had from 2017 as we wrap up this episode of A Crush Year in Review. If you'd like to go back and hear any of these conversations in full, go to our website, crushperformance.com. Just click on the podcast button and you can access all of our archives that go back for years and years and years. Such great conversations over the years. Look, our main objective, everybody, is to inspire, motivate, educate. We're talking to parents, we're talking to coaches, we're talking to athletes, business owners, managers, anybody who's trying to get better, trying to tap into their potential. That's what this show is all about. Sport just happens to be our platform, but the parallels between sport, life, business, music, the performing arts is uncanny. Human development, human performance, skill acquisition, and talent development are very, very consistent no matter what you're trying to do. And that's why we love doing this show. And the show, of course, would not be possible without our great longtime sponsors, Sherwood Dodge Chrysler Jeep, Spectrum Rental, United Cycle, the Glen Sather Sports Medicine Clinic, Marmot Basin, and the Best Western Jasper Inn & Suites, and of course you, our great audience who we are so passionate about. So thanks for tuning in today, everybody. Next week, we will continue our year in review with three more fantastic conversations as we wrap up 2017 and get set for a blockbuster 2018. Talk to you then, everyone.
Goodbye now. Don't forget to write.
Here is Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera with an Inside the Dugout Quick Fix.
Let me run through all of this for you. So we talk about luxury tax. It's not really called luxury tax. Its actual name is the competitive balance tax.
Right.
And this is from MLB.com. Those who carry payrolls above the threshold are taxed on each dollar above the threshold. and the tax rate increasing based on the number of consecutive years a club has exceeded that threshold. The threshold was $189 million in 14, 15, and 16, but the following increases were put together in this next collective bargaining agreement. So 2017, the luxury tax was $195 million. 2018, it's $197. 2019, it's $206, and so on and so forth. The reason I bring this up is there's a penalty that goes along with this as well. So if you're over the competitive balance tax, the luxury tax.
For simple terms, we call it the luxury tax.
The luxury tax. So the first time you're over the luxury tax, right, you get taxed 20% on all the overages. So if you spent more than $195 million, every dollar that you spend, you pay a 20-cent tax back to the rest of baseball.
Right. You're paying $1.20 is what you're paying.
Okay. So when you exceed that threshold for the second consecutive year, that figure goes up to 30%. Three or more straight seasons of exceeding that threshold comes to a 50% luxury tax. Now, here's the important thing for Dodger fans and Yankee fans as well.
Yeah, that's right.
If you dip below that tax, you reset the clock. So if I'm above 1 year, I pay 20. I'm above 2 years, I pay 30. If I continue, I'm above 50. And I get to that 50 point, all I got to do is get below the threshold once and I reset the tax back to 20%. Clubs that exceed that threshold by $20 million to $40 million are also subject to a 12% surtax. Meanwhile, those who exceed it by more than $40 million are taxed at 42.5% rate of the first 45% they exceed more than $40 million. In the beginning of 2018, clubs that were $40 million or more above the threshold shall have their highest selection in the Rule 4 draft move back 10 places unless the pick falls into the top six. So if you're way above this luxury tax, the way the Dodgers have been 5 straight years, Yankees have been 15 straight years, you got to get right under the CBA.
Inside the Dugout with Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.